I want to welcome everyone tonight to the Florida Action Committee monthly membership call. It is June 3rd, 2021. My name is Anita, and I'm the chair of the membership team. We are honored tonight to have with us Dr. Alyssa Ackerman, assistant professor in the Division of Politics, Administration, and Justice at California State University, Fullerton. Dr. Ackerman is internationally recognized for her contributions in the field and her innovative approach that has helped hundreds of people on their path towards healing. She has dedicated her career to studying sex crimes policy and practice. The etiology, the cause and origin of sexual offending, the effects of sexual victimization, and more recently, restorative justice options for those impacted by sexual harm. She is a survivor scholar in that she integrates her personal experience with sexual violence with her professional experience as a sex crimes researcher. Dr. Ackerman has worked with over 500 men and women who have perpetrated acts of sexual harm, using vicarious restorative justice practices, and serves as a restorative justice practitioner in traditional restorative justice cases involving sexual harm in the community. She has written extensively on topics related to sexual violence in blogs and magazine articles, and has published over 35 peer-reviewed journal articles. She has authored and edited 6 books and recently served as the co-editor on a special edition of the Journal of Sexual Abuse. Her most recent book, Healing from Sexual Violence, The Case for Vicarious Restorative Justice, co-authored by Dr. Jill Levinson, was published in 2019. Dr. Ackerman has worked across North America, Australia, and New Zealand. She has given over 50 national and international talks on her sex crimes work, including a TED Talk on the importance of connection. And she co-hosts a popular podcast, Beyond Fear, the Sex Crimes Podcast, which I encourage you all to follow. Now, dear members and guests, I want to remind you that our mission with Florida Action Committee is to educate the public, the media, and the legislators, and we start by educating ourselves. Dr. Ackerman is here tonight to educate us on restorative justice and a path forward so that we, in turn, can educate others. It is my privilege tonight to welcome Dr. Alyssa Ackerman.
Thank you so much, Anita. It is really an honor to get to be here tonight to talk with all of you. I'll start by saying that I am very much an open book, and I'm going to share some of my personal journey with you tonight. And I hope that there's time for some questions at the end, and I will answer those openly and honestly for all of you. So I want to start tonight by talking a little bit about what restorative justice is. So the way that I sort of define restorative justice is that it is a human-centered approach to repairing and preventing harm. And what that means is that it requires honest and often very difficult conversations between people who have experienced harm and people who have caused it. Restorative processes can take on lots of different forms. It can be one-on-one conversations between two people. It can be group conversations. It can include, as I said, the person who has been harmed and the person who caused that harm. Or you can have a proxy person sit in. That's what we call vicarious restorative justice. It can include family members and friends, because as I'm sure most of you know, harm has ripple effects. It doesn't just impact one person. It impacts their support system. It impacts families. It impacts communities. So this approach really allows for people who have experienced harm to talk about the impacts that that harm has had on them, which allows people who have caused harm to really hear and understand the impacts of what they've done in ways that criminal legal responses don't really allow for. And it allows people who have caused harm to really take a hard look at themselves, to be accountable for the harm that they've caused, to name it out loud. And in many instances, it allows for really creative ways for people to give back to help restore the person or the people that they've harmed. And what brought me to that work was my own experience as a survivor. So I've been a criminal justice professor for a long time. I've been teaching classes on criminal justice for about 16 years. And I've taught about restorative justice that whole time. The entire time that I was teaching, I was silent about the fact that I myself am a rape survivor because I did not think that people would take my work seriously. I had spent my career writing about and researching about sex crimes policies and practices here in the United States, and I really thought that people would just think that I was a joke if I ever opened up about my experience. And part of that was shame, part of that was fear, part of that was not wanting people to see me as only a rape victim. So even though I was in a field full of people who study sexual harm, I didn't say anything until 2014 when I started, telling a few people. And Dr. Jill Levinson was one of the first people that I ever told. I had tried to tell her years before that and just couldn't get the words out of my mouth. And so when I told her, she said to me, "You have a really important story to tell. And if people aren't going to take your work seriously, then that's on them. That's not on you. You do really important work." And it was because of that conversation with Dr. Levinson that I came out very, very publicly as a survivor. So the first time I really talked about it publicly was at a talk at the university that I was teaching at. It was a public talk. There was probably about 150 people there. And it was so liberating to tell that story. But it wasn't enough to just share the story. I needed to find ways to integrate it into my work. And that's why when Anita read my bio, it says that I am a survivor scholar because I cannot do the work that I do professionally without owning the personal piece. And the personal journey that I've been able to take couldn't have happened the way that it did without the professional expertise that I have. So 2 years after I told Dr. Levinson, I was in Florida visiting my family. It's where I grew up. And she asked me if I'd come speak to the men in her treatment group, but she wanted me to come as Alyssa, the rape survivor, not Dr. Ackerman, the sex crimes expert. So I said, okay. Now, I have been around people, working with people. I have been in prison cells and civil commitment centers. I have been around people who have committed acts of sexual harm my whole career. But this was the first time I didn't have the Dr. Ackerman shield. And I say that because when I say I'm Dr. Ackerman, I'm an expert, that's kind of a armor that I wear. And I had to take that off to be able to have really vulnerable, open, authentic conversations that night. And that night changed my life, and I know that it changed the lives of the men that I had the opportunity to speak with. In fact, there was a man in the group who asked if he could give me a hug, and I said yes, and we had this really, really beautiful moment hugging one another. And it was because of that, that the next night, Dr. Levinson actually took me to the place where I was raped, and I was able to make peace with it. it was just a beach. And as I said, that wouldn't have been able to happen without the men in that group. What I learned from that was that when you are open and vulnerable and curious and non-judgmental and safe, that people are willing to open up and they're willing to listen, they're willing to share. And that's what happened that night. We all shared, we all listened, and I've had the opportunity to go back and speak to those men several times now. And we've built connection with one another, and that's what my TED Talk is about. And so from that first opportunity, Dr. Levinson and I began talking about, you know, what is it that, what did we do? And what we determined is that we actually had done restorative justice. Because oftentimes, you know, treatment groups, in prison groups, will have victim impact panels where crime survivors come and share their story, but they don't get to interact with people who have harmed. They don't get to people who have harmed don't get to share. There's no room for connection. So we decided that what we had done was restorative justice, and we wanted to build on that first session. And so we built from there. And now I have done that work with over 500 people in treatment programs in multiple U.S. states. I have also started doing work in the California prison system, where I have done work with men who have committed homicide and who are serving life sentences, working on self-forgiveness with them. And I have a practice in the community for people who didn't necessarily go through a criminal legal process, but who still want to be accountable for the harm that they've caused. So that's kind of my restorative justice practice. The other part of my work is on sex crimes legislation. And really, my expertise has been built on studying those laws. And so I wanted to talk a little bit today about post-conviction policies and kind of where I stand on them. My basic stance is that current policies are ineffective. They are harmful to people who are forced to register, and they are harmful to the family members of people who are forced to register. They don't really do anything to help with reintegration. They certainly don't really do anything to help people who have experienced sexual harm. I can tell you for certain that there's no registry that would have prevented my victimization. It was a man that I met at a party. And so I don't really find current policies, especially policies in the state of Florida, to be effective or helpful. They certainly don't help build connection. And they make life really difficult for people who are forced to register, which is the worst thing that we can do. If we want to prevent sexual harm, then we need to provide opportunities not only for connection and you know, relationships with other people, but stable employment and stable housing and people not living in fear. And that's kind of what the registry does. So I don't think that the laws that we have really do anything to prevent future harm. In fact, the vast majority of new sex crimes that occur are committed by people who are not on registries. And I find that these laws make it really difficult for people to seek out help when they need it. Now, we know that most people who experience sexual harm know the person who harmed them. And so oftentimes registration and notification policies and residence restriction policies stop people who have been harmed from wanting to go to the criminal justice system for help because they know someplace inside them, they know that the outcome is not going to be a good one for anybody. So if we want policies that really do work, what we need to do is provide opportunities for people who have been harmed to be heard, to provide educational opportunities, prevention opportunities, where we teach young people about the importance of using proper terminology for their body parts, for teaching people about signs of abuse, for making it less shameful for people to talk about, and that includes people who have caused sexual harm, because we know a lot of them are survivors too. It requires that we take a trauma-informed approach to all aspects of sexual offending. And there's really been a lot of great work in that realm, but I think that our policies themselves, registration, notification, residence restrictions, kind of the complex web of local, state, and federal policies that we have are not trauma-informed. And it makes it really scary for people. I think we need to move away from this us versus them mentality that somehow we have victims and we have offenders and it's that black and white, because it's not. We're all just people. One of the things that I learned back doing these first groups with Dr. Levinson, I remember a man in the group who said, "Why do you want to be in a room with people like us, with a bunch of sex offenders?" And I said, "Well, I'm not in a room with a bunch of sex offenders. I'm in a room with a bunch of people who happen to have committed sexual offenses." And that's a very different feel, right? That label, sex offender, you actually won't ever hear me use it. And many of my colleagues have also sort of moved away from that language, because that label comes with so much shame. And all of us, we are so much more than the worst thing we've ever done or the worst thing that's ever happened to us. So we have to move away from those labels as if they define us. And restorative justice gives people opportunities to see people as more than that label, than that thing. The reason that I was able to go back to the beach where I was raped. So I've always known that people who commit sex crimes are just people who happen to have committed offenses. But in my trauma, in that pain, it was hard to see the man who harmed me as anything more than the harm that he caused me. But in those groups that night, I saw a group of men who had experienced pain, who had experienced trauma, who they were dealing with stuff too, and they were just people who deserved connection, who deserved conversation, who deserved compassion, and they saw that in me too. That is what allowed me to go back to that place, was that human connection. So I think not only investing in prevention, but investing in restorative justice options, not necessarily one-on-one with the person that somebody has harmed, because oftentimes people who have experienced sexual harm don't want those conversations, or people who have caused sexual harm are not allowed to be in conversation with the person that they harmed, or they've committed an offense that doesn't involve another person. It may be an internet, you know, related offense. These conversations are still really helpful, and that's why the vicarious restorative justice process exists. So if we really, really cared about prevention, if we really cared about decreasing the amount of sexual harm that happens, then the first thing that lawmakers need to do is move away from a public registry and away from residence restrictions not only because it's harmful to people and their families who are on those registries, but it perpetuates a myth that's just not true, and that is this stranger danger myth. And it takes us away from really important conversations we need to be having about where sexual harm actually happens, which is in our homes, in our schools, in our places of worship. It's committed by people that we know. So if we move away from public registries, residence restrictions, like this, as I said, this complex web of local, state, and federal laws, and put our money toward prevention education that teaches young people about where harm actually happens, how to talk about it, who to talk to about it, that helps people who think that they may be at risk to offend to get the help that they need anonymously, and there are places that do that. That's really where we get the most bang for our buck. And that's how we end this. We stop making sexual harm so taboo. We talk about it openly. We provide help for people. We provide mental health services for people. We provide education around healthy sexuality. Those kinds of things are how we end sexual harm. But naming and shaming and further isolating people doesn't actually do anything to prevent future violence. So how do we get politicians and judges and prosecutors to see that sometimes their actions are harmful? It's talking like this, right? It's sharing personal experiences. Most of us who've experienced sexual harm do not see a reflection of ourselves in current legislation, right? Like most of the laws that we have been named after young children who were abducted and sexually violated and murdered by strangers. And that's not, it's not me. It's not most of us. And most of us don't want to go through a criminal justice process because it is more harmful than the original harm we experienced. So when we talk to lawmakers in this way, and we talk about the human story, I think that's how we move the needle a little bit. And I think that's the same way that we get the public to understand, right? I teach classes on sex crimes. I teach classes on restorative justice. I give public talks all the time because I think if you reach one person and then they reach one person and then they reach one person, that's how we're going to make this change. It's going to be slow. But the change is coming. When I first started this work in 2004, 2005, I was told, do not focus on sex crimes because you will never get a job. And I am now a tenured professor at a university, being here able to talk to you, doing work internationally, helping people change their lives. And when I first started talking about the restorative justice work, most people said, I don't want to hear you talk about this at all. And I was called every name in the book. And now those same people are coming and saying, okay, now I'm interested. I want to learn about this. So there are moments that have felt very lonely, but I see the change happening. It might not be fast enough, but I do see it happening. So what you can do, if you've learned anything from what I've shared with you, is to have a conversation with one other person about what it meant to you, what you heard, what you see reflected in yourself, and keep on having these conversations. They are risky to have, but they are really, really beneficial to people. So I want to stop it there and answer questions that anybody may have.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Ackerman. I'm going to go ahead and go to the question and answer period. I'm going to unmute you again here. Let's see. There we go. All right. If you have a question for Dr. Ackerman, if you would please just do a star 6 and a number 1 on your keypad, and that'll put you into the queue. And we have our first caller. This is Kim from Highlands County. Hello, Kim.
Hi. Hey, so I was wondering, with listening to what you're saying, have you ever been able to reach out to the Senator Books?
I have not.
Because with your situation, and maybe with you reaching to her, maybe she will change her stance on some of the legislation that she's trying to push through.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe another direction. I, too, am a rape victim. Never reported it. Reached out to family and didn't get solutions. But one thing, I talked to another coordinator, and it was shared that, you know, we have these 800 numbers for, like, suicide, drug issues. Why don't we have one for 800 for sex offenders? So when they're going through their own issues, they have somebody they can call.
It's a really good question. There are programs internationally that do that. I'm checking something right now, actually, because I believe there is one here in the United States. I just want to make sure I get my information right. So the organization Stop It Now actually has a 1-888 prevent line that I'm reading directly from the site. These programs reach out to adults who are concerned about inappropriate sexualized behavior in another adult, adolescent, or child, and to adults who are concerned about their own thoughts and behaviors. So that does exist, and there are programs in other countries that exist as well. But people fear reaching out because, especially if they are afraid that they're going to harm a child.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the backlash to that. So even though that line exists, there have been research studies that have been done that asked mental health professionals, if somebody came to you and said that they thought that they might offend, even if they never touched a child, what would you do? And the answer is, I would report it. And so I think there's a real fear about using hotlines like that.
Yeah. That's sad because, you know, I think that if we can reach out, you know, in a preventative way, I think that would be so much more awesome
mm-hmm.
than after the fact. So,
I agree.
All right, thank you. I really appreciate
you, Kim.
Your talk.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kim. Our next caller is Joe. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Dr. Ackerman. Good evening. You mentioned that in part you've also worked with people convicted of homicide crimes, and there's a very good restorative justice film out there called Another Justice,
mm-hmm.
if you've heard of the film. And, of course, one of the persons in the film was my friend Connor McBride, if you know about, and Kate Romier's, who wrote the book Forgiving My Daughter's Killer. And so, when I was at Wakulla Correctional, I was introduced to restorative justice and how, if we applied restorative justice to violent crime as a whole in America, we would have a better outcome. Yes, violent offenders would still be held accountable and incarcerated, but it doesn't mean that they would have to serve a naturalized sentence or even face the death penalty, or just as the merit of the heavy things that come with violent crime. But and I'm just reading a lot about the story of this boy in St. Augustine, Florida, Aiden Fucci, and the young girl Tristan Bailey, and how now they direct filed against him. So I said, that's not a solution. He's a 14-year-old boy. He did something wrong. He must be helped, you know, and not be ruined and be incarcerated and tried as an adult. I'm just seeing things like that, you know, it's the way we treat violent crime in America is because it is that way. It's a knee-jerk reaction about pro-revenge, pro-retaliation, and pro-retribution versus finding a solution, a healthier solution to violent crime than you know, making a balloon up to this worst thing, and then, you know, it's not a solution. It's just a punishment scheme, you know, from what I'm seeing, you know, in that. So, you know, I'm glad to see how your restorative justice, you're involved in restorative justice too, and that even though you're a victim, you're a survivor, but you're helping others, and you're helping convicted felons get better too, which is a blessing. You know, mm-hmm. So it's good to hear that from you in your thought process.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Okay, we don't have anybody else queued up. Oh, I'm sorry, we do. Wait a minute. I'll get back to that. Our next caller is Gus. Welcome, Gus. Hello? Hello, Gus?
I'm sorry. I was on mute. So you can hear me now, right?
Yes.
Okay. I really like that concept of stop it now. And I actually thought, you know, they have a toll-free number and maybe something similar to like an AA type approach where potentially somebody that has gone through this can be of better help. I decided that I wanted to send them my email, and but every time that I input it for a contact connect with us, it says it's not a valid email address. And I've tried two of my emails that I have, and they're valid addresses. And I'm just wondering, do you know if for some reason they don't wish to have people that potentially have done something in the past be associated with Stop It Now?
You know, I don't know much about the organization itself, so I can't really answer the question.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Gus. Sure. Our next caller is Grover. Welcome, Grover.
Thank you, and good evening, Dr. Ackerman and everyone on the call. Dr. Ackerman, as I listen, I'm hearing the same thing over and over and over again, how there has been progress made. And I'll get to the question in just a second, how there's been progress made in that we realize that it's not effective. If anything, it's more harmful with the draconian ordinances, laws, rules, regulations. Makes no difference where somebody's residing. If they're going to commit a crime, they're going to commit it. If they're not, they're not. So my question is, for after all this research and study and knowledge that has been poured into the subject, what more can be done to finally undo the wrong and the harm that's been done by the registry, by the rules, the ordinances? What difference does it make if someone, where they live, their email, or what vehicle they drive, and how to get this to where it can be more integrative?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And I think the answer is continued conversations like this at a larger scale. And the reason that I say that, so if you go back to sort of my own timeline in this, I spent years writing peer-reviewed papers, journal articles, you know, studying this, and it wasn't making a difference in the lives of people who are forced to register, and it wasn't making a difference in the lives of people who've experienced harm. And so I shifted my career, right? So I still am a researcher and I'm still a professor, but my work is in the community. It's being on a call like this, right? It's having one-on-one conversations with lawmakers to get them to make a change. But just doing the research, it doesn't actually make the change. And I think that the reason that laws haven't changed more quickly is because, number one, there is still a lot of public fear. There's a lot of myths that people believe about people who have sexually harmed. And I think that lawmakers are really afraid of losing their seats, losing their spot to make laws, because if they repeal or abolish sex crimes legislation, they will be seen as soft on crime. That's why they don't change it. But if we can show that other options, other tools are effective at reducing rates of sexual harm, and we can show that it is changing people's lives, maybe they will listen. And that is my hope.
I thank you. And that's the operative word I hear is maybe. Thank you, Dr. Ackerman.
Sure.
Thank you, Grover. Our next caller is Olivia. Olivia, are you there?
Okay, I was muted. Thank you, Dr. Ackerman, and good evening, everybody. Just a follow-up on Glover. I believe, and this is my thought, that even with all the research that is being done and has been done and the education resources, I think it is, as Dr. Ackerman said, politicians do not want to appear as soft on crime. And entrenched in this in this line is the political ambition of legislators. They want to satisfy the public by being tough on crime. And the other reason, Glover, I think, is the money. Money. We just read the sting operations, and they get a lot of federal funding when they arrest men, law-abiding men, who are lured by this law enforcement agencies, the entrapment by phone or by email. And so these are the two factors that we need to look into, is the political ambition of legislators and the funding, federal funding, that goes into the treasury of law enforcement.
Yeah, you know, I would say a couple of things. Number one, so I don't agree with sting operations the way that they have been used, but I will say that if somebody is going online and talking to minors in ways that are sexual, that can be really, really harmful for minors. So the way that these sting operations are set up, I do not agree with at all. But I do think that we have to deal with the real issue that there are people who will go online and talk to minors in hopes to meet them. So we have to have prevention measures in place to stop that from happening. And I think that funding is a big issue, and I think that political ambition is a big issue. But I really believe that lawmakers believe that they are passing these laws because it is what is helpful to victims of sex crimes. And in fact, there was a recent study that found that lawmakers pass legislation or try to enact legislation because of a specific instance of sexual victimization in mind. And so I think that it's really key that conversations with lawmakers, both at the state level and at the federal level, focus on the fact that most people who experience sexual harm don't agree with these policies. That they don't see a reflection of themselves, that these policies do not help them to heal, that the criminal justice process is more difficult and more harmful for them, and it's why so many of us stay silent. I think that is the way to address lawmakers. It's not just the funding and the political ambition. I believe they think that they are doing the right thing. I just think that they're ill-informed.
Thank you. We have our next caller, Thomas. Hello, are you there?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for your talk, Dr. Ackerman. I really appreciate it. and I'm very interested in educating myself far, you know, a lot more on this subject. So is there, my question is there, besides, you know, tuning into your podcast, is there any way we're able to access your articles to read? And then maybe, you know.
Yeah, so there's definitely stuff that I have written online for people who are able to access the internet. And if you just type in my name, and I can spell it out for you, it's A-L-I-S-S-A. And my last name is Ackerman, A-C-K-E-R-M-A-N. So if you type in my name and restorative justice, a lot of what I have written about this will come up. Most of the peer-reviewed articles, I know that some of them have been, you know, talked about on Florida Action Committee. I've seen that. And there are other sites that have talked about that work, but most of that is behind paywalls. I'm happy to make some of them available to Florida Action Committee. And then the book that I just wrote with Dr. Levinson, it's by Safer Society Press, to learn about the restorative justice piece, that's what I would go to, is that book.
And the title is Restorative Justice, A Path Forward?
The title is Healing from Sexual Violence, The Case for Vicarious Restorative Justice.
And I'd like to remind everyone that we do have a post on the FAC website that I put up before this call that does have the link to Dr. Ackerman's website, the link to the TED Talk, and to this book that she just referenced, Healing from Sexual Violence. So you will find some of that information on the recent post on the site. And if I receive any of those links from you, Dr. Ackerman, I'm happy to make those available to everyone.
Sure.
Thank you, Thomas. We have another caller from Orlando. I'm sorry, I don't have your first name here. Who are we speaking to?
My name's Ryan.
Ryan? And you
yes,
are in
ma'am.
Orange County?
Yes, I'm in Orlando.
Okay. All right.
I'm sorry. The question I wanted to ask, my case is also one of that sting operation, the entrapment. And in my case, I tried to stop the conversation a few times. I was a heavy drug user at the time, and they kept emailing me, and I did end up responding back and made a huge mistake that night by leaving the house. But I found out after prison that I'm on regular probation with special conditions rather than sex offender probation, but I have no idea what the difference is. Is there anything you can help me with that?
So I can't, because one, I am not a lawyer, and two, I am not familiar with either county or state laws in Florida, as I have been out of that state for almost 20 years.
Okay.
Ryan, you're here in Orange County, and we have a meet and greet scheduled at the end of the month. I'll be sure that you're notified. We may have an attorney present at that time.
That'd be great.
Okay, thank you. All right,
thank
the
you.
Next caller is Donald.
Yes, I wanted to make sure that you hear me.
Yes, we can.
Okay, so my question is that I feel like getting this conversation started with the committee. My understanding, there's a committee that meets once a year. I think 3 or 4 years ago, it was in Amelia Island in Nassau County. And I know it consists of Sheriff's Department employees. I'm a retired police officer. 2009 is when the offense occurred. So I know police officers of the registration department will go to this committee. I know that prosecutors will go to the committee, and I'm assuming probably some other people. I'm not exactly sure. First of all, are you familiar with that committee that meets once a year to be able to discuss what possible laws or other restrictions that they can put on offenders? Because I think that was one of the reasons why the tag information was required about, 4 years ago or whenever that started. So is it possible that we can somehow get, our conversation started with those people, because they may be the ones also recommending these new rules and regulations to the senators to be able to start their process. So any thoughts on that?
So I'm not familiar with the committee, but I'm certainly, I think that a committee like that is a great place to be having these conversations. So how to make that happen in the state of Florida, I don't know. As I said, I left Florida, 20 years ago. But, my roots are there and a lot of my work is there. And if there is a way to have those conversations, I'm certainly interested in being a part of them or helping people to be a part of it. I just don't know enough about it.
Well, what I'd like to do is maybe try to we have a local sponsor, his name is Brad, up here in Duval area. Maybe try to get more information so I can help, us, if there is a such committee, find out when they're meeting and if we are able to speak or if citizens are able to speak, maybe we can have you as one of the speakers in.
That would be great.
Thank you, Don.
We'll
be looking for more information on that.
We have
Joe again, and this would be the last call. There's no one in the queue after this, so we can take your question, Joe.
Yes. Oh, and Dr. Ackerman, I was going to share with you that when I was incarcerated at Wakulla Correction, which is a faith-based program, I was able to be a co-facilitator for the Victim Awareness Victim Impact class. And one thing that we had in our documentation is that 84% of convicted felons have suffered from abuse, trauma, and violence from their childhoods and their youth. So 84% of felons are victims themselves. And so we have a perpetual vicious cycle of that victimized people become future victimizers. So it's just one thing that I kind of read, which is astonishing, that if when you look at the life and you do a psychoanalysis of 84% of the incarcerated or on parole and probation, you can see those patterns from their childhoods and not having the healthy environments to grow up in, or finding diversion intervention and proper mental health access, maybe we would have kept them from becoming a worse person down the road as an adult. That's just a thought process, something that I remember reading that research. So I thought I would share that with you if you wanted to give feedback on that thought. So
you are 100% correct. People who end up in prison have incredibly high rates of adverse childhood experiences, and people who have committed sex offenses have the highest rates of adverse childhood experiences. So you're spot on. And I would say there was one thing that you said that I want to push back on, and you said that if we looked at this stuff, it would help people from becoming a worse person. I don't believe that anybody who commits a sexual offense is a bad person. I think that good people do bad things. I think people make mistakes. I think that there are deeply ingrained negative coping mechanisms that people have. But I believe that pretty much everybody is redeemable. I think we're all capable of causing harm. We're all capable of being harmed. But I really don't believe at the core of my being that people are bad people. So I just want to push back on that one little thing. But you're right. Hurt people. And when that hurt is not healed, more harm happens. And that is why I advocate to change our current policies, because they don't help people to heal. They cause further harm, which, and you cannot stop harm by causing more harm. It's never going to work. So we have to provide opportunities for healing. That's why I talk about trauma-informed practice, and I learned that from Dr. Jill Levinson, right? You have to treat the root causes of why somebody might offend. And oftentimes that goes back to childhood experiences that were really harmful and never addressed.
Thank you. We have one more caller, and this will be the last call. James from Brevard.
Hello there. I wanted to say thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you so much for your share tonight, Dr. Ackerman. It was just very, very moving. And the perspective, it's just amazing to hear a perspective from a victim. And it's ironic. Something that you said, I hope I'm able to enunciate this as good as the thought in my head was when you said it, but none of the laws and none of the restrictions, and you can't go to a park and locking people up because they have a car in their driveway that's not registered with the county. And this just happened in Volusia. There's been a bunch of people that got put back in jail because they had vehicles on their property that weren't registered in the criminal data system. And guess what? None of those laws are helping victims. None of those laws are helping. And something else you said, and I have a question after, but it is amazing that all the laws that that basically control my day-to-day are basically laws that are named after murdered children and sex offenses to murdered children. I didn't murder anyone, and I don't know anyone in my counseling groups, and in the prison time I did, none of them murdered anyone, and it's ironic that our life now, and when I apply for jobs and everything else and where I can park my car and where I'm able to shop and buy gas, my lifestyle is structured around laws that were written against people that murdered children. And I'm just wondering if there's a balance there that can happen on that. And the last thing I'll say, and then I guess a question for your feedback, it's ironic if a hypothetical person committed a murder and they got out of prison, they would have more rights and freedoms than I do. They're caught, you know, the cars and boats on their property and where they're going to parks, being able to go shopping next to that happens to have a daycare or a school in there, and they can go buy groceries there. And, you know, it's ironic because the laws for firearms, I agree with them, but violent offenders shouldn't be able to buy guns. It makes a lot of sense. But then why are we lumping in offenders and basically the criteria and the structure of their lives are going to be based around laws that are applicable to people that murder children? And how do we get these talking points that you eloquently put more than I did to the lawmakers?
So it's an important question. And even the parents, so for example, Patty Wetterling, the mother of Jacob Wetterling, who, you know, the Jacob Wetterling Act is the federal policy that mandated states to have registries, has said on the record, this was never the intent of registration. It was supposed to be for a small fraction of people who are known to repeat these crimes, who are known, who are harming children that they do not know. It was never meant to have nearly a million people forced to register. So this was never the intent. I think that the conversations that need to happen are not the academic ones. It's not Dr. Ackerman coming to talk to lawmakers. It's Alyssa, the survivor, coming to talk to lawmakers. It's people who have perpetrated harm. And I have a colleague in the state of Connecticut who was just pardoned by the state, who does advocacy work and talks to lawmakers in the state of Connecticut as someone who was forced to register and has now been pardoned. So those conversations are happening. I think they're just not happening on the scale that we need them to. But there is some work happening at the national level, national groups that are doing work to help people who have been forced to register become advocates to be able to talk to lawmakers. So that is very, very promising.
Thank you. That was our last caller, and we are approaching the 9 o'clock hour. I want to thank you, Dr. Ackerman, for sharing your experience and guiding us forward. I wish that we could have had every legislator on this call taking notes and realizing that if they truly want to stop sexual abuse, the day has come for them to accept that laws created on emotion or for revenge or for political gain must stop now. And we know the significant damage that it has done to the offender and to their families trying to restore their lives. But they also need to recognize and accept responsibility for the damage that these same ineffective policies and laws have had on the person harmed by the abuse and their families. And it's time for lawmakers, especially here in Florida, to reform those policies and laws. And when they do finally sit down at that table to take a look at these long overdue process of reforming these laws, I hope that they have a seat for you, Dr. Ackerman, along with other experts at their table. I appreciate your time tonight and the information that you've provided to us. And at this time, I would like to say good night and welcome everybody again to our next call on in July. So thank you again for being with us.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Have a good evening.
You too. Have a good night.
Thank you.